Afternoon is going to be Mimi Misun Kim, and she will speak on identifying trends in outpatient substance abuse treatment for crack use abuse, revisiting the National Drug Abuse Treatment System Survey Study.
Hi, everyone. I want to first acknowledge the co-authors on this future paper, which include Daniel Howard from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Center for Health Policy at Meharry Medical College, and Paul Godley from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Today I'll be discussing, I'll be looking at variables related to crack treatment from outpatient substance abuse treatment units from the National Drug Abuse Treatment System Survey Study. And I'll be referring to that study as the ENDA. I don't have any disclosures to share at this time. So since the late 1980s, research on crack has become increasingly complex, both at a national and global level, and has been examined within various contexts. When looking at the pattern of crack use since its inception, in the 70s it peaked. Then in the 80s there was a significant decline. And then in the 90s, since the 90s, the level of crack use has basically remained stable. There's also been a suggestion that, in looking at the patterns, that the use of crack begins in adolescence. So originally emerging to replace cocaine, crack has become very widespread in inner cities that are marked with poverty, a lack of resources, high rates of unemployment, and low levels of literacy. Common risks for addiction to crack include a genetic predisposition, family history, environment, prior drug exposure, and physical abuse. In addition, many people become addicted because it's just so easy, it's so cheap, and it's so accessible. And there's a significant psychoactive effect. This results in a lot of potential physical risks, including a high level of STDs due to unsafe sexual practices, respiratory compromises, chest pains, cardiovascular disease, strokes, comas, hypothermia, and involuntary convulsions. And when looking at adolescents specifically, there's also a pattern of historically, there's been a pattern of adolescents transitioning from smoking crack exclusively to a period of using heroin or cocaine and subsequently falling deeply into injectable drug use. When looking at barriers to treatment for crack, there are several individual as well as organizational barriers. In terms of individual barriers, we're talking about motivation and treatment readiness, unemployment, insurance status, ability to pay for treatment, transportation, childcare, and scheduling difficulties, and just basic accessibility. Organizationally, research has looked at issues of cultural competency among staff, race, ethnicity of the staff, quality and skills of the staff, and basically the overall ability for staff, for clinicians to conceptualize the complexity of problems socioculturally that are related to, that contribute to crack use. The crack cocaine epidemic has had significant policy and health implications for many African American communities. The most insidious aspect of the crack cocaine epidemic is just its low cost compared to pure powder cocaine. The growing use of crack cocaine did ignite the Anti-Drug Abuse Act in the 80s, 1986, and basically the policy changed the law regarding powder cocaine and crack cocaine offenses by equating 1 gram of crack cocaine to 100 grams of cocaine. So the irony there is that though the policy impacts street dealers and abusers who were more likely to possess crack, Individuals charged with crack possession received longer sentences than a dealer who possessed 100 times more cocaine. By 1988, within 2 years after the Anti-Drug Abuse Act was passed, there was an established minimum mandatory sentencing of up to 5 years enacted for individuals charged with possessing crack. So this analysis looks at a large sample of outpatient substance abuse treatments over a decade between 1995 and 2005. Specifically, the study determines if racial disparities still exist in crack use and abuse, and also what are the current trends in crack treatment for crack abuse. We'll look at several client characteristics and organizational characteristics that could potentially be predictors of crack abuse over time. So in terms of the NDATs, the citation Haringa 1996 will give you a good overview. It's a very long-standing study, and I'm not going to go into the details of it for you today. But it is a mixed panel design, which combine elements from cross-sectional and panel designs. And again, we're only looking at 1995, 2005 was the most recent wave collected. The total nationally representative stratified sample in 1995 consisted of 618 units, and 577 units are included in this analysis. Any units that were excluded was just that was just based on missing data on crack treatment. The dependent variable in the analysis is crack use over time reported in the total OSAT. Referring to the outpatient substance abuse treatment unit, reported in the total OSAT unit population. The original item asks, during the most recent complete fiscal year, what percent of all your unit's outpatient substance abuse clients had any of the following types of substance abuse as a problem? Colon. It went through a list, and it specifically asked about crack. That's the item that the dependent variable was based on. We dichotomized it at the mean percent of the unit's client population who had a problem with using crack, and it was 23.3%. Measures of all of the director characteristics and treatment characteristics were obtained from interview data. And the organizational and client characteristics were obtained from the clinical supervisor surveys. So you can see here, organizationally, there were just questions in terms of public versus private, number of clients served, and then all of the client variables, for the most part, were just split at the mean. In terms of race, we just split it at 50% to measure whether there was a majority of African American or not. So for the analysis, we conducted a logistic regression, generalized estimating equations with a logistic link to measure trends over time. We first looked, and you'll see this on the next slide, but we first looked at bivariate associations for each of the independent variables with the outcome. Then we ran a multivariable model, including all of the variables that were significant, at least at a p less than 0.1 level, so nearly significant. This is a sample overview. In this, you can see that there were 577 units in 1995, and in 2005 there were 530. I'm only presenting to you the variables where there was a significant difference between the two waves of data. And so here we have there was not a significant difference in the level of crack use between the two waves of data, which is consistent with what the research presents, that crack use has remained stable since the 1990s. So that's, you can read that however you want to read it. Troubling and consistent, not surprising. The mean percentage of clients above the age of 40 was just under 51% in 95, with a significantly higher percentage of clients in 2005. So that may suggest that we are looking at, that's a pretty I'm not saying that 40 is old. I am 39. but are these? It brings up the question of whether or not these people started using in adolescence, their long-term, and or if there was some type of peak just in this sample between 1995 and 2005 that led to the significant increase in 2005. I'd be interested in what your theories are. In terms of, there was an increase in multiple drug use between the two waves, which, as all of us know who are doing substance abuse research, that is an increasing, very troubling trend. And so are these, this brings up the potential question of what drugs people are using. Does it follow the same pattern that adolescents seem to be following where the injectable drugs are what's growing among this population? Also, in terms of dual diagnosis, there was a significant increase between 1995 and 2005. And there was also a significant increase in terms of the mean percentage of referral from law enforcement. So I'll get to this in my discussion section, but the referral from law enforcement has a lot of policy implications that are important when looking at crack. This is the logistic regression I was referring to. So bivariately, you can see what is interesting I'd like to focus on the client characteristics. So you can see this very high, I'll focus on the client characteristics because those are the variables that remained significant from the bivariate results to the multivariate results. And that's having a majority of African American clients is highly predictive and positively predictive with a higher level of crack use in the unit. Also, having a higher percentage of clients who are unemployed and having a higher percentage of clients who use multiple drugs. So in examining this sample, we can see that of the included units, over one-third of the units in 1995 were found to have higher levels of crack use, while slightly more had reported crack use in 2005. I think that that's the most interesting finding, one of the most interesting findings to highlight, as I mentioned before, because it's consistent with what the trend of crack use has been documented as over the years. Organizationally, units were predominantly privately owned with a mean number of 691 clients. I don't know, with all of the changes in care and insurance status, whether and how many of these units have changed from being private to public. But there are also results that suggest a difference in terms of the level of individual and group therapy that these units were providing to over the years. So is it an issue of the quality of care that these clients are receiving, and that it's not accessible given the limitations of our fiscal environment and what treatment is available out there? In terms of the client population, slightly half of the unit client population was above the mean in terms of unemployment. That's consistent with previous research, use of multiple drugs, and dual diagnosis. Slightly more than half of the unit clients were above the mean were above the mean in terms of age, and also those referred by law enforcement. So, in terms of law enforcement, there was this, as I talked about, this Anti-Drug Act of 1986. In response to that, there's been a lot of discussion about whether or not that policy is fair. I think that it's pretty apparent that it's not. in response to that, finally, the Obama administration introduced the Fair Sentencing Act. Now, there are still people who are contending that the original policy of 1986 had nothing to do, that there's no racial disparity there. And it's baffling. I'm looking out. I'm seeing some expressions on people. It is baffling, but there are plenty of people who are saying that. But aside from the crack epidemic, historically, there is a very apparent pattern of African Americans receiving longer jail sentences than their Caucasian counterparts. So this is a strong suggestion of the importance of factors to consider in policies with drug treatment and just in terms of our racial disparity work, in terms of racial and community profiling, the lack of good legal representation, and the and specifically in terms of crack, the discrepancy of crack versus cocaine policies, and the overall broader issue of racism. The disparity in crack-related treatment and sentencing should be further examined both at a policy and clinical level, and hopefully I've proven that to you a little bit today. Thank you. Does anyone have any questions?
Questions for Dr. Kim? Don't all speak at once.
I know, last but not least, guys.
Okay, questions for any of our other panel members? Any burning questions? Okay, please join me in thanking our panel members for their presentations today, and I'm sure they'll be here for a second if you want to follow up with them on any questions you have on their work. But please join me.